Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Stephen McCauley, whose latest novel is Alternatives to Sex. Earlier novels include True Enough, Man of the House, The Easy Way Out, and The Object of My Affection. This is your fifth novel. As with two or three of the other novels, it deals with the relationships between straight women and gay men in various capacities. Maybe all of your books do.
There's usually some kind of central relationship or central friendship in the book that involves a gay man, often the narrator of the book, and a woman friend. But I think they all have some kind of different, you know, texture. The first book, Object of My Affection, was about a really romantic friendship. It was kind of a love affair, a chaste love affair. The other sorts of friendships are a little bit more complicated. In this one, well, I really wanted to write about someone who falls in love with a couple, you know, married couple, and kind of idealizes them and sees them as a role model for himself in some ways and, you know, wants to be part of their lives. But the couple themselves in this book didn't turn out to be quite as likable as I wanted them to be. And so the relationship is of a different nature.
The main character, William Collins, said, "A lot of people I know started talking about real estate the way they once talked about love and sexual conquests. He's a real estate agent, and the alternative to sex is what?"
It's talking about real estate, it's obsessing over real estate, it's, you know, lusting after certain properties and the condo that you wish you had bought 12 years ago. I know a lot of people who are poring over real estate. A lot of people I know call it real estate porn. You know, they go onto the websites, they look at places in the city you're living in, places all over the country, with this kind of lustful attitude. And it has taken on, I think, this kind of erotic charge, you know, the perfect place to live, the place that's going to make your life better than it is or different. So that was why I wanted to write about a real estate agent, one of the reasons.
What set you off exactly? Where did that little light bulb go off?
Really, the initial inspiration was to write about someone falling in love with a couple. And the other thing that interested me about that is because I'm in a long-term relationship, you know, part of a couple for a long time, I think there's this funny kind of loneliness that occurs in couples because you know the other person really well. You can anticipate their reactions to things. And it's almost like being alone all of a sudden. And couples often drag a third person into their relationship, not necessarily in a sexual way, but just someone that they can bounce their thoughts off of. And, you know, you invite someone into your house and you see things with a fresh eye. And that's initially what I really wanted to write about. But then I got much more interested in the narrator, William, and his various obsessive behaviors. I wanted to give him some kind of a job that involved intimate contact with people where you get inside their lives and inside their houses, and real estate just seemed the perfect job for him. And I've been working on a prospective, you know, TV series with some people for, I don't know, about a year, and the guy was a real estate agent, and it seemed like the ideal job for someone in for a TV series, because everybody who walks into that office has got a little drama going on with a divorce or a marriage or, you know, they've got new kids, whatever. There's always some kind of a big story attached to it. So I'd already done some research.
William Collins also wants to be celibate, but he keeps going online and meeting these guys, all of whom lie, and he
right.
lies.
Right.
How common is that kind of lying, do you think?
I think it is absolutely pervasive. I think that's part of the appeal of being on the computer, is that you can exaggerate your assets and minimize your, you know, problems. And it's a lot like selling a house. You know, it's like you go on and you've got this really coded language about what the house is and how it looks, cozy country kitchen and that sort of thing to describe a rundown wreck of a place. And people use those same kinds of terms to describe themselves online. You know, I'm not sure it's exactly active lying. It's almost this funny kind of wish fulfillment, which amounts to the same thing, I suppose.
Well, if someone says that they're 30 and they're 50 and they weigh 300 pounds when they say they weigh 150, there's a certain point when the people meet and they learn the truth.
Well, you know, but it's amazing to me how many people do that kind of lying and sort of get away with it, you know? Because here's the thing. I think a lot of people, they lie about who they are and what they look like and so on. And then you meet someone and, well, it's 10:30 and you got nothing else going on, so you might as well go through with it. Sometimes it works.
Not to put too much of a fine point on this, but it seems that you could almost make an analogy between how people lie on the internet and what's happening in Washington and Bush and lying, because you see a pattern here. I mean, has America become a country of liars from top to bottom?
Certainly from the top, you know, if we consider the administration the top. You know, I think that's one of the most frightening things that's happened over the past 6 years is this complete distortion of truth and distortion of language. And, you know, it is total 1984. You know, war is peace.
Then it trickles down to internet porn and real estate porn?
And almost every place in the culture, you know, reality TV, which is no more real than any of the scripted TV. It's all very carefully edited and people are fed lines and, you know, we think we're looking at their real lives and, of course, we're not at all. And all this recent business about memoirs and, you know, what someone's memoir is, in fact, completely fabricated or largely fabricated. So there's this real blurring of truth and fiction, and you know, who knows where it ends. I've been trying to do, because this is written in the first person, and it seemed to me that this was a kind of comic monologue, maybe more so than my other novels, in which the narrator, you know, is telling a story but also has a lot of digressions about social observations and that sort of thing. When I've been doing readings from it, I've been trying to deliver it almost like a comic monologue, and I've memorized portions of it. And so it's almost like the narrator is speaking to the people, you know, the five people assembled in the bookstore. And the questions afterwards are generally, you know, like, so how long have you been celibate? And I said, well, yeah, I'm not celibate. You know, this is a novel. And then the next question is, well, do you consider this a self-help book? And so on. So I don't know. I don't know where it's all going.
They've conflated fiction and nonfiction completely. They think you're the protagonist. I mean, this is a novel.
Yeah. Yeah, but I guess if I want to be completely honest, I would have to say that the way I've been reading it in bookstores is intentionally blurring the lines a little bit just to make it a more interesting experience listening to it.
You know, I still wonder about that because it seems like people should have figured this out. If you were going to write nonfiction or if you were going to say this is somewhat of a memoir, you would say it. I mean, we could say that maybe Object of My Affection, because it's your first novel. Yeah. Was that part memoir or was that all novel too?
No, that was all novel. I mean, you know, everything that I write and most people, of course, it has some roots in. I had a shrink once and she asked me what I did for a living. I said, well, I write novels. And she said, oh, fiction novels? And I said, yeah. And I thought it was really a bad beginning to this therapeutic relationship, but I stayed in it for a couple of years anyway.
Stephen McCauley, you have several other characters. Let's talk first about the couple, Charlotte and Sam. You said that as you were beginning to write it, you expected them to be somewhat lovable, and they turned out to be far less lovable than you thought, and in terms of the novel, far less important in the context of the novel, which brings up the question, the writing of the novel, what changes? What happens? How do you perceive those changes?
I generally begin with a sense of a strong central character and some kind of situation, and then, you know, I just pursue it. I really don't have an idea of where things are going, and I just try and follow the character stories. I think it's a really inefficient way to write, and it causes me a lot of problems in the process, but it seems to be the way I do it. You know, I'm not that interested in plot in any traditional sense. I'd much rather just follow the lives of the characters.
So you just begin writing, see where it goes, and then one day you wake up and go, huh, these characters, they're just not really cool people.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm gonna stop trying to make them cool because it just wasn't working. They're not horrible.
No.
But, you know, they're not probably someone you want to spend a lot of time with.
William Collins also has a relationship with his tenant, Kumiko, who refuses to pay the rent. She's involved in yoga. You were a yoga teacher, and you still do yoga, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Had that been in any of your other books?
No, I don't think so.
Why did you decide to bring it in now?
I think it's just become so much a, you know, mainstream cultural thing that it's just a little bit silly. I mean, I started doing yoga when I was 15. People were doing yoga in church basements, and, you know, it was a little bit of an outsider business. I see it as a form of exercise. That's why I do it. I don't have any particular, you know, spiritual expectations from it or attachments. And to see people doing their little class prayer hands and the whole faux spiritual thing when it's pretty commercialized at this point. I guess I just wanted to satirize that a little bit.
The entire relationship between William Collins and Cameco is a fully comic relationship.
Yeah.
It seems to be. Is she based on anybody you've ever met?
Yeah, she's based on a tenant of mine.
Really?
When Object of My Affection, my first book, was made into a movie, I got you know, one kind of lump paycheck that wasn't a huge amount of money, but it was more than I'd made before, and I bought a house in a town north of Boston, which is kind of real estate, investment property. You know, I rent it out most of the time, and I'm a really terrible landlord because I tend to get involved in people's lives a little bit too much, and I don't maintain a professional distance, and I just got very connected to this one tenant who seemed initially like a really nice person, and maybe she was, but it just was, you know, really hell trying to get the rent out of her. And I would spend, as William does in this book, you know, hours mapping out these payment schedules, and I was embarrassed to ask her for, you know, like her tax forms to find out if she could actually afford the rent, and ended up, you know, telling her my whole financial background, so thinking that maybe if I tell her how little money I've got, she'll end up paying me the rent. And never worked out.
Did she ever pay anything?
She never paid much, and finally she agreed to move out. And she wasn't moving out, so then I said, okay, I'm coming up there on Thursday at noon with a moving van, and I will move you out. And I got there at Thursday at noon, and there was a sign on the door saying, you know, gone for coffee, back in 10 minutes, and nothing had been packed. I mean, anyway, it was a nightmare. I ended up doing all the packing and moving, and then she came back in finally after being out for a couple hours and sort of scolded me for putting the tea bags in with the towels or something. And
God.
Yeah.
You have another character, Edward, who is the best friend of our hero, William Collins. He has a friend named Marty who's kind of this strange self-help guru. She's putting forward this idea that everyone's a success, and she's an absolute wreck.
You know, I used to live down the hall in an apartment building from this guy who's had this apparently very successful business telling other people how to, I don't know, get their business plans together and so on and so forth. And he was very successful doing it, but he was really a wreck. His only business was telling other people how to do their businesses. And there is this whole culture of people who are, you know, like making a lot of money writing books about how to write screenplays, but they're not writing the screenplays themselves, you know.
And never have.
And never have, yeah.
When you're creating a book like this, a novel, how seriously do you look at the idea, is this funny, is this not funny? Or do you just write and then afterward go, huh, hey, this is pretty funny, or this should have been funny and isn't?
I write my novels pretty slowly, and I spend a lot of time rewriting things to try and get the timing right, I guess, so that sentences are funny. And you know, you have the exact same thought, you say it one way, and it strikes me as funny, and another way, and it doesn't. And there's no way to really test that out, and you just have to kind of make a leap of faith. I never really laugh at my own stuff when I'm writing it by any means, and really the only way I know is when I do readings, if people laugh. And I've been doing a lot of readings lately because the book has just come out, and there are just certain lines that I know, well, I know this is going to get a laugh. I don't know, it's a funny business, you know, trying to write comedy.
Yeah, well, that's why I'm asking, because it seems that as I'm reading it, it's like you're walking in unknown territory. You don't have the option of a stand-up comic to test your material out and see if it works.
Yeah.
And when I was going online and looking through reviews of Amazon, one of the books, somebody would say, this isn't as funny as I thought it would be, and it got me thinking about, gee, writing comic novels must be really hard, because you don't know if you've pulled it off or not until the book's in print.
Humor is the most unpredictable thing. I mean, some things just strike people as hilariously funny, and other people just don't get it. And I've gone to book groups, and people are like, oh, man, this book is so funny, and made me laugh, and made me feel good, and blah, blah, blah. And other people say, this was supposed to be a comedy? I didn't know what was funny about it, you know? So you just got to connect with some sensibility. So I take the good with the bad, I guess. What else can you do?
William makes a comment at one point. If everyone were having as much sexual activity as he'd like, there'd be no such thing as road rage, and no one would have ever voted for George W. Bush. I know you agree with that statement, but can you elaborate further?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's probably an example of something that I worked on a little bit for comic effect, because obviously it's a big generalization and very exaggerated. But on the other hand, you know, I kind of believe it, that a lot of bad behavior in the world comes out of sexual frustration. And I'm all kinds of frustration, but a lot of it is sexual frustration. And it seems to me, yeah, you know, it just seemed to me people wouldn't be out there, like, tooting those horns and running up over the sidewalk and screaming at people if they were just kind of relaxed and sexually satisfied. And they certainly wouldn't be voting for Mr. Bush, I think, either.
You're listening to an interview with Stephen McCauley, whose latest novel is Alternatives to Sex. Stephen McCauley, I'd like to talk a little about your career. You grew up outside Boston, went to the University of Vermont. You spent a year in France, in Nice, as a student. What year was that?
That was my senior year of college. It was in the late 70s.
Yeah. Have you used any of that material in any of your books yet?
No, I never have. I was kind of having a rough period when I was in college, and things weren't going so well for me personally, and I had the opportunity to go abroad for a year, and it seemed like a good thing to do, and it was. Unfortunately, I didn't make the best use of my time there in terms of studying. You know, I did a lot of traveling, which was great, but I go to France often now because my books have done pretty well there, and I really regret that, you know, I didn't spend that year diligently studying the language.
Apparently, your novel, True Enough, is going to become a French film.
Yeah. It's supposed to begin shooting in a couple months, and you never know with movies, but it's looking very good at this point.
They transpose New York to Paris?
Yeah. The book is set in Boston and New York, and the novel and the movie will be set in Paris and Lyon, so the sort of, you know, the big city and then the lesser one. A lot of the stuff translated pretty well, I must say. The director and screenwriter is very good, and he made some choices that I thought would not have been my choices, but nonetheless, it's pretty faithful to the book.
And there's no way of knowing what the title will be at this point.
No, the title is going to be La Vérité ou Presque, which is the French title of the novel, sort of the truth or close enough or almost.
Afterward, you came back, you taught yoga, you worked in various jobs. At that point, had you been thinking of being a writer?
I think I wanted to write since I was a child, but it didn't seem like a very obtainable goal, and I put it off for a long time and worked in a travel agency and taught kindergarten and that sort of thing, and then, you know, eventually when I felt as if it was holding me back because it was what I really wanted to do, I got some stuff together and went to graduate school, and that's where I wrote my first novel.
Stephen Koch is listed in one of your bios as kind of a mentor to you. Who is he?
I went to one of these MFA programs at Columbia, and he was a teacher there, and he ran the writing program there for a while. He's written a couple of novels, sort of rather avant-garde kind of novels, and he wrote a really fascinating book about Andy Warhol in the early 70s called Stargazer that you can sometimes find in used bookstores and so on. And it's very interesting. And he most recently wrote a book that was published by Modern Library about teaching writing.
Do you think you can teach writing?
I do teach writing.
But can you really? I mean, other than the details involved.
You can get paid for it. That's the thing that's to keep in mind. You get your health insurance paid for. Yeah, I actually do think you can teach writing. You can't teach talent, and I teach undergraduates at Brandeis outside of Boston, and, you know, you can usually tell within a page if someone's got talent or not, but you can certainly teach people to write more clearly and logically and to drop the affectation and write a little bit more from, you know, their emotional center rather than some fantasy world that they're kind of trying to live in.
Can you teach voice?
How to develop a voice as a character. You know, I'm working with one student right now who has been told her whole life, you know, she's really wanted to write. She's got kind of an interesting background, but that she's just doesn't have enough literary chops. And so she was writing this stuff that was just really elaborate and using vocabulary that she was not comfortable with. And I think I've actually helped her get a little bit closer to her own voice on the page. So maybe.
Your first novel, Object of My Affection, that came out at a time when there were very few gay novels around. I mean, when you were writing it, what was your awareness of that?
There were some gay novels around. I mean,
a few.
You know, there are a few. It certainly wasn't like it is today. I don't know. I mean, this was the story I had to tell and the characters I wanted to write about, and I tried to do it as honestly as I could. I assumed, frankly, that if it were published, which seemed a long shot, that it would be maybe, you know, a small gay press, which did exist at the time. It just came out kind of at the right moment when mainstream publishers were beginning to take on gay novels and realize that they could sell them to, you know, not only was there a big gay audience out there, but that other people were interested in reading them as well.
And you were, I assume, pretty shocked at the response, which was quite extensive.
Yeah, I was shocked that it was published. I mean, you know, to tell you the truth.
It became a film. How do you feel about the film?
The screenplay, which was written by Wendy Wasserstein, who died recently at 55, so tragically young and leaving behind a very young daughter, is very, very different from the novel. She added characters, she changed the whole point of view and so on. I guess my bottom line reaction is, you know, it could have been a lot worse. It's a pleasant movie. I mean, it's an appealing movie. And in its own way, it's kind of honest. And although there's nothing groundbreaking about the movie, it came out in 1998, and there weren't very many studio movies. This is 20th Century Fox. You know, it wasn't one of their little independent offshoots that had a gay male protagonist. You know, that was actually, believe it or not, kind of daring at the time. Now it's people call me up and say, "Oh, I saw that movie on the Family Channel or something." So it's, you know, things have changed.
Your second novel, The Easy Way Out. When you have a great success with your first novel, frequently the second novel is going to get razzed. Insofar as I know of your novels, it's the least well-known today. Did you have that same second novel anxiety, and how do you think it played out?
I'm just a very anxious person in general, so I'm like always anxious about everything all the time. That novel got probably the best reviews of any novel I've written, except for this one. Maybe this one seems to be doing pretty well in the review department. It did well. It sold well. I'm kind of happy with it. I didn't have any problems with it.
Your third novel, Man of the House, that did not get the kind of reviews the other ones had.
I thought that novel was really funny. I still do. And a lot of people tell me it's their favorite of my novels, and it's about relationships between fathers and sons. But a lot of people said, "Oh man, it's so depressing. It's really hope. There's no hope at the end of that novel," which I thought there was. So maybe I just didn't achieve what I was attempting.
Fourth novel was True Enough, and that's about a gay man, straight woman relationship again. They're filming documentaries about an unknown blues singer. Was that singer based on anybody?
She was a little bit. There was a, in the book, her name is Pauline Anderton, and the singer was based a little bit on a singer named Roberta Sherwood, who died maybe about 5 or 6 years ago. She was discovered in a nightclub by Walter Winchell, and she had quite a successful recording career, and then just kind of fell off the map. And I came across her records once in a thrift shop out in Long Island, and I bought them, and I'd never heard of her before, and I really liked her voice. She had this a big voice, and it was kind of very emotive, but at the same time, there was something a little bit amateur about her delivery, and that really appealed to me.
You change point of views at the end of the novel.
Yeah.
And that's kind of unusual. What was the reason?
The book alternating chapters between the man's point of view and this woman's point of view, that, you know, they're working together on this project, and it's her point of view, his point of view. And I thought, well, whose point of view am I going to end it on? Because whoever's point of view it ends with, that will sort of be the last word. Because I saw them as equally important characters in the novel, the logical thing to do to me seemed to be to end it on this outsider's point of view. And the outsider is this kind of irascible poet named Rosemary Boyle, and she makes a cameo appearance in this new book. She doesn't actually appear in the novel, but she's written the introductions to the Simone de Beauvoir books.
Oh, that's her.
Yeah.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah.
She's pretty...
yeah. Very irascible. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Like, don't read this book.
Don't
it's
read
terrible.
This book. Read my book instead. And that was sort of based on this idea that I knew someone who had written a biography of someone and then began writing introductions to this other writer's books.
Do you think a writer has an obligation in a political sense at all? We're going through really tough times, and right. I've asked a lot of writers this question. What is the role of art in all this? Is there a role in art?
You know, I began writing this book after 9/11, and it seemed to me that that was this big political issue, and suddenly there was a huge shift in the atmosphere in the country, and that I couldn't completely ignore that. And so there's a lot of talk about that. The characters in this book are, you know, trying to choose between putting selfishness aside and doing good and, you know, just dropping the whole altruism routine altogether and just doing whatever you can to feel good. And I think that's what a lot of people, I know anyway, were feeling. Because I write comedies, it had to be dealt with in a way that was somewhat comedic but relevant at the same time. And so what I wanted to write about here is just this, the irony of the way people responded to it in their own personal lives. I don't think there's a message in there, but I guess what I would like to think is that, you know, by satirizing certain sorts of behavior, that one is making a political statement.
We've got, you know, a war in Iraq, potentially dictatorial government in Washington, and 9/11 seems to really recede in the background almost.
Yeah, although it's obviously the cornerstone to all of that, and our willingness to accept all of the things that you just mentioned. You know, even the dictatorial leadership in Washington.
Is it harder, do you think, for you as you see things going this direction to write comedy, or does it become easier?
No, I think I always try and focus on people's behavior, you know, and behavior, and people always respond in ways that are surprising and funny, in addition to being touching and sometimes frightening. But I think you can always find the humor in the way people react to things.
Have you started working on another book yet?
Yeah. I've got a character who's in a sort of untenable situation, you know, and I figure I can string that along for 300 pages, see if I can get him to a better place in his life.
Do you ever think about writing any other kinds of books?
When I finish a book, I always think, you know, I could write anything. I could write mysteries. I could write a memoir. I mean, why not? I probably couldn't write a memoir because I have nothing interesting to say, but all kinds of things. But, you know, I think that I, as much as anyone else, maybe more than some, am restricted by the limits of my talent and my intelligence and so on. And I think that, you know, what I feel like I'm always doing is just pushing a little bit against the walls of those limitations.
You've been listening to an interview with Stephen McCauley, whose latest novel is Alternatives to Sex. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.